Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Andrew Lemon, and my job here is to introduce the guest speaker, who happens to be me. So this will make the preliminaries a bit shorter than usual. But firstly, welcome to the RHSV. I'm speaking in my capacity. I think I'm now called Minister of Fun and Games at the RHSV. I have concluded a four-year term as president of the society, and I'd like to welcome you here, particularly for Melbourne Rare Books Week. I'm really thrilled to have Kay Craddock, the inventor of Melbourne Rare Books Week, in my view. I'm sure there are politics behind all of that, Kay has been a council member here at the RHSV and has been a great supporter of ours. So welcome, Kay. Welcome to all of you who are there are some familiar faces, some very familiar faces here as well today, but to any visitors, particularly welcome you. I want to just give a couple of disclaimers. The advertised time for this lecture was from 12 till 2, and you'll be thrilled to know that I'm not planning to talk to you for 2 hours, but if at any stage you feel the need to disappear, there's being a lunchtime lecture, that's quite understood, and I won't take it as a personal affront. So do feel free to leave as come and go as hello Diane as required. So that's my first disclaimer. The second disclaimer is that I'm not a book expert. Many of you are. Many of you know the world of books and book collecting intimately and know all the nuances. I guess I'm a mere historian. I use books. Is the word collected books? I find books somehow seem to come to me, but I've managed to resist the impulse to actually get too acquisitive, except occasionally. But I defer to your greater knowledge and wisdom of the book collecting world. Secondly, as president of this organisation, I expected after 4 years I would have intimately known the entire collection. I can tell you I'm almost as ignorant of the collection of the RHSV now as I was 4 years ago, because you're nodding your head there, Lenore, the vice president. Yeah, that's the point. You've got lots of things to do apart from sitting down and reading and working your way through the collection. And the third disclaimer I want to make is we're going to pay a visit to Henry Giles Turner today, a very significant figure in the history of Victorian books and literature. I'm not really an expert on Turner himself. I've written biographies of some of his contemporaries, in particular one of his contemporaries, the Honourable James Balfour. Turner has always had in my history a kind of bit part. He's walked on, he's played his part, and I thought this would be an opportunity to look at him in a little bit more detail today. He was one of the founders of this organisation, the Historical Society of Victoria, as it was in 1909, and there are a number of books that came from his collection and which are also books that are written by him that are part of our rare books here at the Society. He's a man who's possibly been found himself on the wrong side of history in recent years, and I think that it's worth having a look at him and his role. So I think the quotation for the day to start off is Turner's own observation, written 100 years ago, that the rising generation in Australia takes, as a rule, little interest in history, not even the history of their own country. So the Historical Society's been going for 100 years, and same story. So Turner was a man who supported, in particular, the public library, now the State Library of Victoria, and this organisation. He was president of the trustees of the public library. He was vice president of the Royal Geographical Society, which is an organisation which merged into the Historical Society of Victoria, and he was involved in the merger of those bodies. And of course, you're surrounded by an exhibition of royalty. We're feeling very extremely royal at the moment, particularly today. But the purpose of this exhibition is really to show the way in which royal references have pervaded Melbourne and Victoria. Like it or not, they are there everywhere, and particularly that rising generation sometimes can need a bit of help in explaining who all these different kings, dukes, queens, princes were and why they kept changing their names. Just to confuse you all. So that's the context in which we're sitting here today. And I think Turner probably would have been quite at home there. Well, if we're going to pay a visit to Henry Giles Turner, the best way of doing it is through this splendid book, Victoria's Representative Men at Home. This one here is one of the facsimile edition that was produced in 1977 by Today's Heritage, which was Michael Cannon's imprint, if you like. And Guy Featherstone, who has curated the... There's a small cabinet that you'll see near the spiral stairs, which has some of Turner's works in it. Guy tells me that the facsimile editions are on the market, are reaching similar prices to the originals. There's some interesting minor differences between the two. The one that's in our display case is the first edition. So in a moment I'll just show you the inside of this. The first edition was produced by Melbourne Punch. It was Punch's illustrated interviews by the journalist Lauderdale. Now, most journalists worked under Nom de Plume in this period. I'm not sure whether anybody here can tell me who Lauderdale really was, what his real name was. We know many of those nom de plume, but Lauderdale wrote a series of articles for Punch, and they were articles about the movers and shakers of Melbourne. And Lauderdale's photograph appears in some of the, as he interviews his representative men at home. But I haven't yet been able to tell you who he was. This was produced in 1904, and it's the National Library suggests that the first edition was limited to 50 copies. And again, I'm not sure if that's correct, but that's what the National Library suggests. And I know that it's held in only four public libraries, and there's a copy in the Supreme Court of the Queensland Library. So the RHSV's copy is certainly one of our most rare books. It is in the cabinet there. It is a splendidly embossed red leather binding copy, and ours is inscribed to Sir Arthur Snowden, MLC. It has some torn pages, and the contents page have been annotated by enthusiastic RHSV volunteer in years gone by to list the names of the houses associated with the representative men. At the time, that would have been regarded as a bit of book vandalism, but now I suppose it's part of the patina of the book, and it therefore adds to the value and intrigue of it. If I were to do it now, you'd be horrified. To anyone who knows Melbourne and Victoria, the names of these splendid piles that these representative men lived in still resonate. They include Stonington, Raheen, Hayington, Fortuna, Bishop's Court, and Snowden's house itself was St Helier's at Abbotsford. So let's just have a look inside. The general principle is that Lauderdale goes to visit one of these gentlemen at home and is always impressed by their magnificent homes. I realised that it was a bit like there were parts of Toorak that used to remind me of Norlane in a way, in the sense that there was rows of Housing Commission mansions. That's to say, each mansion seemed to be identical to the mansion next door. Of course, very few of them survive. I suppose Labassa, Ripponlea might be examples that would still come to mind. But the whole purpose of this is it's like the beginning of celebrity journalism. It's to allow the hoi polloi to look behind the scenes and see what's actually inside these magnificent homes. It's a book that really got me into the Victorian era when I first came across it when I was studying history. The object of the exercise is The introduction says, every man, gentle and simple, has two worlds. One world is that which is open to the gaze of his fellows. The other is the sphere of private life, seen only by the members of his family, his relations and his intimate acquaintances. He is not necessarily a hypocrite or a cheat because he wears two faces. It does not follow that he has skeletons in his cupboard because he does not appear in public in the same attire or with the same frank, careless smile so familiar to his family and his friends. There is a sense that in the Victorian and the Edwardian era that the public man, and these are all men, many of them have splendid ladies who also grace their homes, but all of these representatives are men, they're going to have a public face and a private face. And so the introduction concludes with his preliminary overture, "We beg to draw aside the curtain." So if we go to visit Henry Giles Turner, he's in his splendid home called Bundalone, which was in Tennyson Street, St Kilda. Now there's a block of flats on Tennyson Street and there's Bundalone Court, but I don't know if anybody who knows that area, it's just next to the St Kilda gardens, whether the original house is still there, hidden away behind the flats. It is still there. It's gone? There, gone. I'm wondering whether it's hidden secretly away behind.
Still there.
Still there. Okay, I think so. Okay. So as you can see, it's harder to find now than it was. Now Henry Giles Turner gets in here on page 103, and just after the Honourable James Balfour, and he. So if I very carefully hold this book up to you here, Bundalone is there at the top. As you can see, it has the necessary tower, and it would be looking out, fronting Tennyson Street, looking out across the gardens. And the lovely pictures there include the library with its open bookshelves, generous table and chairs, and Mr. Turner seated thereat discussing things with Lauderdale. There's the dining room with lots of fine paintings on the wall, many of them by well-known artists. No mincing of words under this caption here. Mr. Turner, in his 70s, the caption is photoed, "The Evening of a Sunny Life." Below is the drawing room, and here Mr. Turner and two ladies, who we must take to be the highly esteemed and philanthropic Mrs. Turner and their companion, the widow of Alexander Sutherland. Interestingly enough, Alexander Sutherland, who'd be the subject of another interesting talk of interesting literary figures in Melbourne's history, in a rather Dickensian twist, Turner adopted Elizabeth Sutherland when she was the widow of Alexander Sutherland. They remained a threesome, as they might have said, there at. And then over the page we have the picture of the vestibule with a very splendid staircase, a pair of stained glass windows which I later learned depict dawn and evening. And down here we have Mrs. Turner attending to numerous correspondence in her boudoir. And the final snapshot is of the coach and pair, because there's a running joke through this whole article that Mr. Turner is so busy with so many appointments, it's very difficult to get time to talk to him. He's got at least four appointments that afternoon, and so here's the final snap of the carriage and pair about to depart to take Turner, no doubt, to a meeting of the trustees of the public library. It's the period when he was just before he became the president of the trustees. So who is Henry Giles Turner, and what else does he have to do with Rare Book Week? The main topic of discussion between Lauderdale and Turner is really about Turner's views of education and the need for high-status practical training in business, agriculture, manufacturing and trade, radically seeing the United States as a model rather than British education. He's asking for a wider education system that is going to embrace study of all of these things. He's concerned that the that the wealthier classes tend to push their children towards the professions, and that Australia needs more practical, intelligent education. It's really interesting to really get into some of Turner's philosophies. Now, the probably the best way of giving you a brief understanding of Turner's very versatile and long life is really to take you through Ian McCallman's entry in the Australian Dictionary of Biography. Ian McCallman is now a distinguished professor of history at Sydney University, but he wrote this entry back in 1976. It's a very good entry in the ADB, I'm decided I'll rather than read you the whole of that entry, we'll give a little bit of a annotated conversation through it. In fact, McCallman, I think, takes some of his biographical information from Turner's own descriptions of his own life, and I'm not sure whether some of these pieces of information were properly tested by biographical research. But what we're told about Turner is that he's born in London in 1831. And again, I find it really interesting. He's 90 years old when he dies in 1920. So you're dealing with somebody who's born before Melbourne is established as a town. He's somebody who arrives here on the 4th of December 1854, which is the day of the Eureka Stockade Rebellion. He dies in 1920, and of course there are people still alive today who were born before Turner died. He's the first real historian of the colony of Victoria, so I think that he's a really interesting example of what, in a way, what an extraordinary change has happened in just two lifetimes. He was born in London, in the centre of London. His father was William Turner, a tailor, his mother, Carolyn Nee Giles. It always says in these sources that his schooling was at Poland Street Boys Academy, where he revealed an early love of literature and history in his capture of several school prizes, extensive reading and attempts at historical narrative and verse composition. I do think this is something that needs a bit more exploration, because I've gone looking for Poland Street Academy, celebrated or not, I can't find it. Poland Street is in the middle of Soho, and I sometimes wondered, did he mean he went to the School of Hard Knocks? I read that in the 19th century, Poland Street was mostly inhabited by small tradesmen and craftsmen, particularly manufacturing jewellers, engravers and carvers. There was St James's Workhouse was there. Perhaps that's where he went to school. And I couldn't resist this listing of the address, number 54 Poland Street, from 1788 to 1792, the house was the home of Elizabeth Billington, who's described in the Dictionary of National Biography as the greatest singer England has ever produced. On account of her generous and amorous disposition, Mrs. Billington was known as the Poland Street Man Trap. Well, there may well have been an exclusive boys' school there in Poland Street, but so that's something that I'm open to more information about. We also understand from him that his first job, and again, this is biography coming from the person who's telling you the story, and sometimes these things are not quite right, but there's no reason to disbelieve him. He was a historian. At the age of 14, his father apprenticed him to the publisher, bookseller, William Pickering. And I know that those of you who are book experts will know that Pickering is one of the great names of English bookselling and book collecting. And Pickering was somebody who both dealt in publishing books himself and also in the antiquarian book trade. And he was at his height, I understand, in the 1830s and 40s. Before he went bankrupt in the 1850s. But again, I stand to be corrected there. But what an education Turner would have had working for the publisher bookseller William Pickering. He says that his family, the fortunes were reversed when he learnt that his mother's legacy had been squandered by her husband, who I suppose was his father, I don't know. And a dishonest trustee, but this was a good preparation for his banking career. So he moved into his first bank job. He's now aged 19. He becomes a clerk at the London Joint Stock Bank, on low pay. And it's worth reminding ourselves that the joint stock banks were quite an innovation in England, even in the 1830s. I think the first joint stock bank was established in the 1830s. So we're talking about not the Bank of England, not private banks, but banks that are owned by shareholders, the model for the type that he runs later in Australia. So he's working in the bank, he's complaining about, he's working long hours, he's complaining about his salaries. He's having a romance. He's seeing a lady by the name of Helen Ramsey, and he speculates that his limited prospects and mediocre status were viewed with disfavour by his prospective mother-in-law. He had literary hobbies and interests. He formed a reading club amongst his colleagues. He had his first taste of controversy, which I think he enjoyed. His book club put out a publication that satirised one of their senior bank officers, and that didn't go down very well. It may or may not be connected to the fact that in 1854 he decides to try another hopeful land where wealth might wait on honest work and toil. He has the gift of the gab. On the way out, he chats up a number of influential Melbourne businessmen and identities, including Coppin the Great, the marvellous theatrical entrepreneur. He gets into their good books. He's already sussed out the place before he arrives. No point going to the gold fields, get a job in the bank, and that's what he's going to do. The romance follows. Helen follows him out to Melbourne. In September 1855, they marry at Peran, according to the rites of the Church of Scotland. So he continues his literary interests and promotions. He becomes chief accountant of the Bank of Australia in 1864. So 10 years after he's arrived, he's on the way up. In the meantime, he's pursuing a wide range of cultural and recreational interests, including sport and amateur theatricals. He actually acted with Coppin and various other people in amateur or semi-professional performances. He started writing. And Ian McCalman says, in 1856-57, Sidney Gibbons, an aspiring journalist, offered Turner space in the Illustrated Journal of Australasia and Monthly Magazine and introduced him to Melbourne's literati, including James Smith, Sir Archibald Michie, George Gordon McCrae, Nicholas Chevalier, and fellow bank employee Marcus Clark. His first Australian literary magazines followed. With the encouragement of these friends, he helped launch the short-lived Australian Monthly Magazine in 1865, and he contributed articles to weekly periodicals such as Melbourne's Spectator, Clark's Colonial Monthly, and James Smith's satirical Touchstone. He was also a founder, a leading contributor, and first president in 1868-70 of an organisation, the Eclectic Association. The Eclectic Association was indeed eclectic in the questions that it argued and debated and discussed. But he was not just an indoors man, he was an outdoors man. McCalman describes Turner as tall and muscular, with a great love of the outdoors. He is attributed with founding the Banks Rowing Club. Now, for years, I always assumed Banks Rowing Club meant it was on the banks of the Yarra. No, you knew that, but I didn't. I knew about the hardware. I'd done some work on the McEwan's company. I knew that the hardware people had their rowing club. The banks had their rowing club, and that's where that came from. And he personally helped to defend their annual trophy, rowing for them in the 1860s, later serving for many years as president of the Victorian Rowing Association. On holidays, he explored the countryside, the Yuyangs, Mornington Peninsula, rode on horseback to the Murray River and beyond. And in June 1870, the Commercial Bank of Australia offers him the general managership in Melbourne. So it's in the 1870s, so we're talking about, he's born in 1830, so he's getting into his 40s that Turner really establishes his reputation as a banker. It's later reported that Turner took the Commercial Bank of Australia, which was a fairly small organisation based here in Melbourne, from the edge of ruin to prosperity. He greatly increased the capital, he allowed the capital to increase and opened branches everywhere. McCalman attributes this to hard and conscientious work, wooing mercantile and family and farming interests, and distributing shareholders' profits with caution. And so here we get to the land boom and the bust. Now, we, with our glorious hindsight, know it's looming, but Turner didn't quite see it coming. And he wasn't the only one. As Victoria prospered in the aftermath of the gold boom, he advanced easy credit on the basis of land securities, a practice which stimulated the bank's expansion and which he justified as essential to the colony's growth. I'm quoting McCallum here. By the late 1880s, his success and articles in financial journals had made Turner one of Melbourne's most influential bankers. He was elected fellow of the Bankers Institute in London in 1880. Now, that again sounds very grand, but in fact the Bankers Institute in London was founded only 2 years earlier, so he was one of the people who was, helping to boost this idea that bankers know what's going to happen and they are wise people and you should listen to what they say. He was asked by the Victorian government in 1882 to help negotiate a $4 million loan in England, and he served as a commissioner to the Bordeaux Wine Exhibition, where apparently the Australian wines did particularly well. So he was over there doing that. In 1886, he became a founder and first president of the Bankers Institute of Victoria, and the next year, honorary treasurer of the Queen's Fund, the great philanthropic fund set up in the 1880s, particularly under the patronage of Lady Locke, the wife of the governor. He was also a banking appointee, in fact the only banker on the Royal Commission on Banking. He was president of the Chamber of Commerce, chairman of the Associated Banks. His name was in lights. And as a big banker in all senses of the word, he continued his literary enthusiasms. So McCallum lists some of them. Turner was trustee, treasurer of the Yorick Club, founder of the Kew Literary Institute and Free Library. He yearned to produce a high-class literature magazine, and in November 1875, a dozen friends, including Alexander Sutherland, launched the Melbourne Review, and we have a copy of the first volume of the Melbourne Review in the exhibition cabinet. Its reputation as Australia's first successful quality review, acquired in a decade of production, owed much to Turner's efforts as contributor, editorial committee chairman and editor. So, of course, he's emulating the other famous reviews that are out and about, the Edinburgh Review, Westminster Review, North American Review and so on. So then we start getting the public roles in Turner's life. Trustee of the Public Library, Museum and National Gallery from 1884. Commissioner of the Centennial International Exhibition in 1887-88. Now, I can add that he became president of the trustees of the library in 1905 after the death of Edward Langton, to whom he was vice president. And he presided over the Jubilee of the library in 1906, in which he made a passionate plea for more space and better facilities in the library. Those of us who were trying to get those sorts of things happening 15 or 20 years ago really could have just quoted Turner talking about 1906. But his big goal was to get a big, decent building for the library. And lo and behold, the Dome Reading Room was built in 1913. And I'm sure you've all had a chance to see the exhibition down in the State Library, but it's a marvellous exhibition, and it tells the whole history of the development of that building and the site. And so the Dome Reading Room is something that people talk to the government about. You should do something to actually get governments to be prepared to spend big money on major public buildings like that is a great achievement. And I think it probably required somebody with Turner's literary skills and his commercial skills and his political skills to somehow make those things happen. So I don't think we should ever think these things just happen. They happen. I'm sure he does deserve a lot of the credit for that. So Turner, as early as 1906, is advocating the creation of a central reading room of octagonal design like that new Congressional Library in Washington. And so we have also Turner, the controversialist, the person of the Eclectic Club, controversialist on religion, controversialist in science, controversialist on spiritual questions. There was this great upsurge of interest, as you all know, through Alfred Deakin and those stories in spiritualism in the 19th century. He was deeply involved in the Melbourne Unitarian Church, which in a sense is regarded as a liberal-minded church. So he's out there making his arguments, doing his contributions. And then there's Turner, the man of substance, the builder and occupier of Bundalone, completed in 1886, where McCalman tells us he entertained with a lavishness typical of the decade. Then there was Turner, who managed to survive the crash of the 1890s. Now, the CBA barely made it. Many of you in the room are old enough to remember the Commercial Bank of Australia. It's the one that, of course, finally disappeared into the merger with the Bank of New South Wales to become the euphoniously named Westpac Bank. So the CBA's disappeared, but the great banking chamber, what's now 333 Collins Street, subject of something of a heritage battle, ironically being constructed as the land boom got worse, the building got higher, and it was finished in the depths of the 1890s depression. Well, the CBA did hang on, unlike several other banks that collapsed, but hung on with a lot of people paying the penalty. Depositors had their funds frozen in the great bank closure of Easter of 1893. Shareholders saw their dividends cease and their capital disappear, and worse, they were called upon to contribute unpaid capital on their shares, and it's often that became the last straw for many people. They finding their income had gone, and they actually continued to have a liability to this joint stock bank. They called up the money, and of course that put many other people into insolvency. Customers had overdrafts abruptly called in. Many lost their collateral. McCalman explains it in this way. It was in Rome in 1889 that Turner learned that the boom has bust, but of course the ramifications took some years to follow. But for a scheme that lowered interest and delayed repayment to creditors, the bank would have collapsed. Turner blamed the disaster on dishonest finance companies, government ineptitude, and the reckless policies of his locum in 1888. You'll know from that list that he wasn't actually on that list, the historians tend to think that he's equally culpable through injudicious backing of land speculators, of course, in the 1880s. And he had to continue. He really wanted to retire. He was ready to retire. He had to continue in what he now found an uncongenial post. But he remained there until in 1901 he was satisfied that reconstruction was complete. So the CBA survived the bank crash with Turner's reputation somewhat shredded through it. But interestingly enough, Turner himself didn't become bankrupt, and he didn't have to take refuge in the famous secret compositions that Michael Cannon talks about as the basis of his book, The Land Boomers. And the CBA revived to become one of the major banks of Australia. Turner welcomed his retirement at 70 with undisguised relief, says McCalman, having joined Sutherland to produce the book The Development of Australian Literature in 1898. He was impatient to begin on what became his 1904 two-volume History of the Colony of Victoria, from its discovery to its absorption into the Commonwealth of Australia, published in London. And it was followed in 1911 by his instant history. You know how there's always a history of, there's probably already a history of the second prime ministership of Kevin Rudd, probably out there for Christmas. So they used to put out books pretty quickly even in those days. So this was the first decade of our Australian Commonwealth, 1911. And 2 years later, the very well-known little book, Our Own Little Rebellion, The Story of the Eureka Stockade, both published in Melbourne. Thereafter, he continued to foster a high culture and a community of letters in Melbourne. Now, McCalman sums him up as a paradoxical figure, and I always think as a historian, probably we should always avoid saying somebody's a paradox because it means we haven't actually worked them out. But I suppose it means there are contradictions in terms. So I think the contradictions in terms in Turner's life is that we tend to see him through the focus or through the prism of our own time, and we expect that somebody who's a conservative banker such as Turner is going to have a set of opinions which line up to what we think conservative bankers would have today. And in some ways, his opinions do exactly that, and in some ways they're worse, and in some ways they're different, and so you're not necessarily going to find that Turner ticks all the boxes that you might attribute to a line of industry who happens to have a sporting and literary bent. So I think that Turner probably thought that he was completely consistent and logical himself. He probably didn't think he was paradoxical. He certainly was interested in... So McCullman, in terms of the paradox, points to these things. He was interested in a wide range of community bodies, including hospitals, schools and charities, yet he was an extreme Spencerian individualist, notorious for advocating eugenics for pauperism and crime. And again, I'd actually come back to that and say that word notorious applied to eugenics is a modern judgment back on eugenics. There's a very interesting PhD by, I think it's Diane Wyndham in the 1990s, talking about the way eugenics was picked up and seen as to do with national fitness and health and so on, and suddenly becomes associated with totalitarianism and the Nazis, and naturally it's repudiated. And in her excellent PhD, she talks about how she said if you looked at the who's who of Australia in the first half of the 19th century, you'd find half of the people there would have described themselves as sympathetic to ideas of eugenics. But she said when it came to writing their obituaries, this was left out. So it's an interesting example of how opinions shift, or the language shifts, because the concepts become degraded. Anyway, McCullman describes him as a banker who attacked socialism, which is quite true, trade unionism and economic protection. He presented an easy target for the Labour press. But Turner's denunciation of capital punishment, British imperialism, Aboriginal murders and white Australia led Bernard O'Dowd to suggest playfully in 1911 that Turner was an anarchist communist. Yeah. He was certainly a libertarian in theology, inclining towards naturalistic theism. Hatred of ecclesiastical tyranny meant that he supported Charles Strong in the Scots Church conflict in 1883, and he became a committee man of the anti-Sabbatarian Sunday Liberation Society the same year, and president of the Education Act Defence League. So the Honourable James Balfour, who I wrote about, who was described at one stage as the linchpin of the whole Wowseristic edifice, the keystone of the whole Wowseristic edifice, would have been, in a sense, a natural opponent of many of the things that Turner believed in. But there they are, nestling in their identical mansions. Well, one was in Kew and one was in St Kilda. So I suppose I'm trying to make the point that it is terribly easy to lump these Victorian gentlemen into one group, whereas in fact it's really fascinating to work out where the subtleties are and where the differences are. Now, there are others apart from McCullman who've studied and written about Turner. There was a contemporary of mine at the University of Melbourne, Renata Kugler, who wrote a BA honours thesis on Turner, and I haven't come across Renata since we studied together, but she did her BA honours thesis on him, partly, I think, encouraged by Graham Davison, who was saying, isn't it curious that apart from Michael Cannon writing about Turner, nobody's actually done a biography of him? And then Pamela Allsop did a MA thesis at Monash in 1993 under the subtitle A Victorian Man of Letters Hero. And it might be worth noting further that what's not said in the ADB article is that Turner, or perhaps it's hinted, was that he was a great traveller, and he talked about the importance for Australians, of the difficulty of Australians who are stuck here, who can't travel because they don't broaden their mind. And he had the money and the impulse to broaden his mind. So he did travel through the US and Canada as well as through Europe, and famously to New Zealand, where he survived a disastrous carriage accident near Christchurch. And I think in the audience today there's somebody who's descended from a fellow traveller on that disastrous carriage expedition. Is that person here today? I did have an email from somebody who said she had some information about that. But so that was called... it was on the road to Akaroa, if any of you have been. Akaroa, the one on the little... out on that peninsula, the carriage fell over. So I could talk a lot more about the fact that really we know Michael... know Turner mainly through what Michael Cannon writes about him, And Cannon is a historian for whom I have huge respect, and I realise that there's a zeitgeist here. I can't say that I am these days a regular reader of Quadrant, but it was pointed out to me that Peter Ryan, who of course was publisher at MUP, had written a piece about Michael Cannon earlier this year, and about the history of the book, The Land Boomers. It was, I suppose, Peter Ryan's best known as in turn publisher and then scourge of the memory of Manning Clark. And Ryan wrote, "It was my privilege over almost half a century to have followed in intimate detail the triumphant bestseller course of one of the most remarkable Australian books of all time, The Land Boomers by Michael Cannon. No full understanding of the concluding decades of the colony of Victoria, nor the subtler character even to this day of its jewelled city, Melbourne, is possible without some apprehension of the land, some appreciation, I think he means, of the land boom era and its appalling bust. For reasons which escape my understanding, the publisher over recent years has ceased to put copies into the bookshops. Out of print, more reprehensibly, the author himself seems to have been left in the dark about the intended future fate of his great work." Now, Cannon's book has been through several different editions, and those of you who are book collectors will know which are the most desirable and collectible of them. Presumably the first edition in 1966. There's also the paper-bound edition in 67. And Cannon himself, frustrated with MUP, put out through his own imprint Heritage Publications the illustrated version under the revised title of Land Boom and Bust. And mine is signed by the author as number 329 of 1,000 copies. So just shows I do have a couple of little interesting items in my personal collection. It's been through a Thomas Nelson edition, through a Lloyd O'Neill edition, and an MUP edition, which is a version of this 1972 edition. So whether it's... I think it's up on the MUP website, but it's been has gone back to its original title, The Land Boomers. Now, Cannon was able to make a few corrections along the way and, of course, put in these splendid illustrations, which, again, tend to... I suppose it's like being in the list of shame if your ancestor appears in Michael Cannon. So I have to make a personal announcement here that my father's uncle is in the list of secret compositions, but he was a very small fry. I think it's a bit mean that he got in there. But anyway, he was looked after by his mates, and he ended up being the secretary of the Carlton Brewery, I think. So my grandfather was a lot younger than his older brother, and so there were all these warnings about the follies of investing and trusting your money to banks in the next generation. So maybe it's a bit like getting a convict if you're in Tasmania, being in the land boomers, and it maybe it become a mark of honour. I'm descended from a land boomer. Well, he was the uncle, not mine. But I think that Cannon had this larger purpose to talk about what happens when human motives of greed and ambition affect capitalism. And he, in one of the blurbs, it says, "The book's lessons remain valid today," today being 1972, "for the boundaries of government intervention in business affairs can never be finally drawn on a society desiring to retain the virtues of free enterprise while attempting to eliminate its rivals." Now, I'm sure Turner would have regarded Cannon as a bit of a red radical, but he, in some senses, if you read the book carefully, Turner is not given too hard a time by Cannon, except perhaps for perhaps provoking the land boom by calling in some of the accounts of the building societies. But in fact, many of those building societies were completely hollow, and who's to say whether that wasn't the right thing to do? But I think there is a need to test. To test Cannon. He's such an enjoyable companion to read that sometimes you assume that he's got it absolutely right. But I did find when I did my biography, part of it was to test how is it that somebody like James Balfour, who appears to be a sort of wowseristic hypocrite, can also be regarded as a magnificent person, a generous, a model for young men to follow, and so on. I wanted to pursue that paradox, and I think that Turner needs a bit more of that kind of work. Well, look, just very quickly as I move towards concluding this lecture, a little bit about his legacy and what we have here in the RHSV collection. Well, of course, we have his History of the Colony of Victoria in two volumes. Volume 1 covers the period 1797 to 1854, so the prehistory of the colony up to the gold rushes, and the second volume, 1854 to 1900. They're published by Longmans Green in London in 1904, and in the Turner Papers in the State Library of Victoria, there's a couple of letters which appear to imply the Turner, not the first and not the last author, had to actually cough up to the publisher to help for the production of this book. It's quite clear that Turner put money into the production of this book, and I think that it's interesting because it's always assumed as being the standard work on the first of the Victorian histories after the end of the colonial period. Turner on the front page, of course, is a Fellow of the Institute of Bankers, London, and a Fellow of the Royal Geographical Society, London, etc., etc. Volume 1 has maps and plans. Now, not all copies of the Colony of Victoria, or the History of the Colony of Victoria, have the maps and plans, so ours does, doesn't it, Guy? And so that's why it's in the case, but if you're a very nice guy, we'll show that to you after the lecture. Plans include the plan of central Melbourne for the first land sales and a map of Victoria. We have a copy in our collection of The Development of Australian Literature by Henry Giles Turner and Alexander Sutherland, with portraits and illustrations, 1898, a very significant contribution to the taking seriously of Australian literature and allowing some of the literary prejudices of Turner and Sutherland to be given full rein. So the focus of their writing is particularly there were some previous articles, including ones on Adam Lindsay Gordon, Henry Kendall, Marcus Clarke, adapted from articles in the Melbourne Review and the Australasian, but also some new material. And Turner, in his book, takes the reader back to what he understood to be the first book printed and published in New South Wales, James Busby's On the Cultivation of the Vine and the Art of Making Wine. Can I ask the learned company, is that still regarded as the first book published in Australia or not? I see no. So just shows you can't believe historians. Well, you can believe that one over there, I think. Thank you, Wallace. he does talk about the growing interest in Britain about Australian thinking and Australian literature, some satirical remarks saying that maybe this interest is due to the visits of the various cricketing teams and their phenomenal success. Some things have changed 100 years later. He notes attempts made by Kendall to take Australian writers seriously, but he also notes a rather... there's another stream of Australian literature which he dislikes. Some very bad examples include a gory compilation of melodramatic impossibilities entitled Ned Kelly, the Ironclad Bushranger, thrilled the great unwashed. And one of the worst of Melbourne stories from a literary point of view, according to Turner, was The Mystery of a Hansom Cab. Said to have attained, says Turner, somewhat disdainfully, a circulation of over 1 million copies and was dramatised to boot, and of course still is. We also have in our cabinet The First Decade of the Australian Commonwealth, a chronicle of contemporary politics, as mentioned, and it's inscribed on the inside to the Historical Society of Victoria with compliments of Henry G. Turner. And I love the opening quote about the first 10 years of the Australian Commonwealth. He quotes Richard III, "Tetchy and wayward was thy infancy." He has his pamphlet on the war with some thoughts on its aftermath in a lecture delivered in the public library on the 7th of June 1916. He has his pamphlet on Alexander Sutherland, MA, his life and work, published by T.C. Lothian. An address delivered by request to the Australian Literature Society in 1907, and it has our Historical Society stamp on it. Sutherland died in 1902. Turner contributed many articles to the Victorian Historical Magazine. It still goes as the Victorian Historical Journal, one of the oldest surviving journals. mostly deriving from talks given to this society, beginning with a day in 1839, Mr. Latrobe's arrival in Victoria, which was a paper that he gave to the Victorian Historical Society on the 5th of February 1911. It's in the first volume of the Victorian Historical Magazine. He wrote on the Batman and Faulkner controversy, which still continues to get airtime in Melbourne. Luckily, all of these journals are available online through the State Library website. All of our journals are digitised up to 1954, and the post-1954 ones will go online soon, so you can find Turner there. But we have those journals here in our collection. We have the Melbourne Review, volume 1, from 1879, where he has his article on banking in Victoria. We have a very good copy of that. We have the... there's a handwritten note on the inside. It's not by him, but it says that Turner's chief journalistic effort was the Melbourne Review, which he founded in 1875. As mentioned, we have versions of both editions of Victoria's Representative Men at Home. And we have Henry Giles Turner, Our Own Little Rebellion, the story of the Eureka Stockade. The spine simply reads the Eureka Stockade, and it was published less beautifully by Whitcomb in Tombs in Melbourne, and our copy is inscribed to the Historical Society of Victoria with the compliments of Henry G. Turner, June 1913. And Turner's book about Eureka is, in a sense, history, and in a sense, it's making a political point, and we were told to discuss this, I remember, in an essay back in when I was studying history at Melbourne University, because what Turner was aware of and what he was trying to do was to put a little bit of block in the way of the mythologising that he could see was going to come, or was already coming, around Eureka. And as Weston Bate often tells us, Ballarat can still be a dangerous place if you have opinions about Eureka Stockade, who was there, where it was, what it represents. The flag of Eureka has become highly symbolic. Small pieces of it are like pieces of the Holy Shroud these days, aren't they? No doubt framed, they would get even more money than a framed portrait of James Hurd. And I think that, in a way, Turner is trying to say, yes, this was a rebellion. It was a rebellion. There was tyranny. People were affected by it. They were right. But in a way, it's a bit like Macaulay writing about the history of England. It's a bit to say, well, but it was all for the good, because it showed the good common sense of the people of Victoria that this didn't turn into, and I say thank God, the American Civil War or anything like that. So he's really pushing the line that Australia has been blessed. We do completely ignore the Aborigines, but we have been blessed with no bloodshed of that kind in Australia. And he's trying to put the line, which I think is still potent today, that that's something that Australia deserves to be proud of. He writes with a great deal of flair. It's naturally a Victorian tone of voice that he's writing with. But there's some lovely expressions, such as... the influx of gold. It was not only the numbers that caused inconvenience, but the varying nationalities to which Australia had theretofore been little accustomed. The majority of these visitors were undoubtedly British, but there were also many Scandinavians, Germans, Americans, and Chinese. Now, the ordinary middle-class Briton is suspicious of foreigners. So when trouble arose on the goldfields as a result of the harsh administration of an unpopular form of taxation, the officials were prompt to blame intriguing foreigners as the fomenters of disaffection. Others blamed the irrepressible ebullition of the fighting instinct of a gang of wild Tipperary boys whose normal instincts set them against the government. Well, I guess sometimes you might need translation, but to get the full enjoyment of this, it's good full English language written by somebody who's a great admirer of literature. And of course, the most famous quote of this: "It was a rebellion, trivial, no doubt, as rebellions go, but yet of sufficient potency to bring about immediately momentous change in methods of dealing with a large section of the population." And of course, Turner knew many of the people who were involved, so well worth a revisit to that. So, as I say, if people do have to leave, please don't be shy, but I just wanted to just mention a couple of the things that are in the connection with the State Library. The State Library has Turner's papers. I don't know, Diane, do you know who would have done the work on listing and annotating the Turner papers in the State Library? No, but it's been well done, and it is available through the library's catalogue, and you can read what's there. There's a complete listing, including some of his correspondence. Unfortunately, his correspondence is not a copious collection, but he certainly has letters to and from George Coppin, Ada Cross or Ada Cambridge, Walter Murdoch, Bernard O'Dowd, P.D. Phillips, George Robertson. George Robertson was not impressed with the idea of spending any more money on the Melbourne Review, I might add. Sir Samuel Way, James Carlton Young setting up a library in Minnesota, Oliver Wendell Holmes, a very interesting collection of correspondence. The State Library also has the address by the President, Henry Giles Turner, on the occasion of, this is part of the title, of the opening of the exhibition of Rare and Curious Books, etc., and of the new building for the extension of the Museum of Natural History in commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the opening of the Public Library, and that full text is available online. And there's also the Victorian Oarsman with a rowing register, the work of John Lang with an introduction by Senator George Fairbairn and a foreword by Mr. Henry Giles Turnbull, who says it should be of much interest to all lovers of the manly sport and ought to command a large circulation. And, of course, in the library as well are some books that came from the library of Turner, because when he died, in fact, many of the pamphlets, the literary pamphlets, the science pamphlets, come from Turner's own collection. Turner died on the 30th of November 1920, aged 88. His will was made in 1915. And he left to the Melbourne Public Library such of the books in my collection relating to Australia as are not already in the said library and which the chief librarian of the said library may select. To his adopted daughter Elizabeth Sutherland, widow of the late Alexander Sutherland, she got £1,000 and she was put in charge of the household and items after his death pending their realisation. He left legacies to the children of Alexander and Eliza Elizabeth Sutherland. He left £1,000 to the University of Melbourne to fund a scholarship encouraging the scientific study of agriculture. And he left money to the Queen's Fund. He left to the Bankers Institute the portrait of myself by E. Phillips Fox. And the Bankers Institute passed it on to the National Gallery, where it still stands. His cousin Emma Eastland, son Brian, got the framed illuminated address from the officers of the Bank of Australasia and the bound illuminated address from the officers of the Commercial Bank of Australia and the silver inkstand presented on his retirement. The Historical Society of Victoria got not a cracker, not a bean. I don't know, it always happens, doesn't it? And yet there he was at the foundation. He was part of the people who merged the Royal Geographical Society. But he did at least in his lifetime give us those important books of his that are part of our collection. There's a second codicil that actually goes into a lot of detail. It says that Edmund Latouche Armstrong, the chief librarian, has to make all the arrangements for the sale as such of such of my books as may not be selected for the said library, with the full power and discretion as to whether to sell such books at public auction or by private contract, all on one day or on one or two more days, whether singly or by lot. Display of books for public inspection, time and place and advertising of such sale, plus choice of auctioneer, Armstrong to supervise this and do the catalogue, but he was at least offered 100 guineas for his efforts. Turner very curiously, or astutely, I should say, no doubt being a banker in the land boom, put the bundle loan was in the name of Mrs. Turner. She actually died before Turner, but she allowed him the use of the property during his lifetime. And so after he died, there was an auction at the Athenaeum of the pictures, marble, statuary, bronzes and china, sterling silver, etc., etc., through the trustees' executors' agency. But the books, the valuable library, which was put up for auction, was withdrawn from sale, having been disposed of in one lot. And again, there may be people here who can tell me who bought the library of Henry Giles Turner. But up for auction nonetheless, when some of those pictures that were in the dining room, the Von Gerards, the Chevaliers, the Bouvelots, the John Mathers, the Walter Withers, the Ashtons. And on January 1921, up went Bundalone as well, two-storey brick roof with slate roof and bluestone foundations, very important. Two magnificent hand-painted windows, and And it was on the market again within a few months because the man who bought it has now to leave for America. Under what circumstances, I don't know. But just very finally, the legacy in his other forms. Well, Professor Ernest Scott was by now the president of the Historical Society, and he described Turner as an indefatigable student of Victoria's historical, of Victoria's history. There was a brass tablet unveiled at the Unitarian Church in 1922, and Dr. Alexander Leeper replaced Turner as president of the Melbourne Public Library. I think Dr. Leeper had fewer people skills than Henry Giles Turner did. But what of the Historical Society? Well, in October 1920, there was a meeting, monthly meeting of the Historical Society of Victoria, and this is from the Argus, held at the Town Hall last evening. It was decided to agree to the arrangements made by the Council for the union of the Society with the Victorian branch of the Royal Geographical Society. So that was done in Turner's lifetime. He died later that year, and in December, there's an idea we should have a memorial to the late Mr. Giles Turner. A meeting of the Council of the Historical Society, the question of suitably commemorating the life and work of the late Mr. Henry Giles Turner, Vice President of the Society, was considered. Mr. Turner's principal literary work having been connected with Victoria, it was thought appropriate the Society should initiate the movement and resolve to call for a meeting to discuss the idea at an early date. One idea was to have the establishment of a prize or scholarship bearing his name for the encouragement of original work in Australian history. Now, this meeting didn't take place until July the next year, and it was then decided, yes, we'll initiate a fund to establish research scholarships in Australian history at the University of Melbourne, the holders of such scholarships to be known as Turner Scholars. A committee was formed to carry out this purpose, and to call a public meeting of the late Mr. Turner's friends and admirers at an early date for the purpose of soliciting subscriptions. Professor Scott, president of the Society, is acting as chairman of the committee. Subscriptions may be sent to Mr. E. Latouche Armstrong of the Public Library, who has consented to act as honorary treasurer. Now, a year later, the fund was closed, and it was decided that there wasn't actually very much in the fund. The amount raised came to just £50. Unfortunately, not enough to keep scholars in luxury for perpetuity. So it was decided instead to offer the unnamed amount collected to the Council of the University to form the nucleus of an Australian Historical Research Fund. It is proposed that the income from the fund, until it becomes large enough to provide a research scholarship, shall be devoted to the provision of a prize to be called the Giles Turner Prize, open to competition among university students taking that portion of British history which includes the history of Australia. Now, there was, of course, the Henry Giles Turner Prize in Agriculture because he'd given them £1,000 in his will. But there never was and never has been a Turner Scholarship in history. But the University of Melbourne still has, talk about secret compositions, on its books, a Henry Giles Turner Scholarship Prize. The conditions are now that the prize consists of the net annual income of the fund and is open to undergraduates of not more than 3 years standing after their first enrolment for an essay on some branch of Australasian history approved by the Professor of History. The prize is not to be awarded to the same person more than once. It now is worth $110 to the lucky winner. There's no roll of honour in the History Department or on their website, but I do happen to know that in 1949, University of Melbourne prizes an exhibition. There was one called the Australian History Giles Turner Prize, and it was won by somebody called Geoffrey Norman Blaney. So, when the Historical Society was begun, Turner said this, that the teaching of history had always been absolutely neglected in the schools of Victoria. There had been little improvement in the last few years, which was mainly due to the great advance in the state school paper. What was wanted was that the history of our country should be brought home to those on whom the future of the Commonwealth would depend. There was much romance in the history of the country and much stimulating interest in its social movements. So that was his message. And there was one other legacy that he gave, and I also wonder what became of that. £100 to the Society for the Relief of Educated Persons in Distress in Melbourne. Where is it when we need it most? Well, that's the end of our visit to Henry Giles Turner. Thank you very much for your attention.